Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tour.com podcast. You know me as Justin Landon, the host of this program, and I have with me tonight Mr. Rob Bedford. Rob is one of the longest-running SSF bloggers with well over a decade in the biz. He's the lead U.S. book reviewer at the often-quoted SFF World. He's a Tour.com blogger, a regular at the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal, and the owner of Rob's blog, Oh Stuff, which is probably one of the worst blog names ever, but he gets extra points for being, like, the first one. So welcome, Rob.
Thanks for having me, Justin. It's not a great name, but it's not specific, so I don't want to pigeonhole myself when I started the thing 10 years ago, so...
Well, I feel like when you started it, it was sort of like the whole creative, like, have a clever name for your blog really wasn't a thing.
And LiveJournal was still active then, so take that for what it's worth.
So you weren't assuming that anybody would actually read it because it wasn't a LiveJournal, right? Like,
you know, right.
Everybody was on LiveJournal.
Exactly. And that's a whole community that I just never never really got into.
It amazes me that some people are still, I mean, I think Shannon McGuire still owns LiveJournal, her and Nick Mamatas. I mean, God, they like dominate that place.
And George R. R. Martin, lest we not forget him.
Yeah, no, George is still working the LiveJournal. Somehow George gets mentioned on like every episode of this podcast in some like weird offhanded way. It's never about him, but we always seem to take a jab at him.
Yeah. It is what it is. Well, you got a big name, it's going to happen.
That's what happens when you're on top of Mount Westeros. So I had the Book Smugglers on a few weeks ago, and we talked about how they were like 80 in blogger years. You know, they've been around since 2007, but that kind of makes you like Methuselah, man.
Something like that, yeah. I've got, you know those dogs that have don't have back legs but have wheels instead? I'm kind of like that, I guess. You know, those little dachshunds sometimes are crawling around and, you know, you feel bad for them, but they're still sweet dogs, so.
You're still kicking. It's still kicking. Yeah, it's been rough. So, primarily, I mean, you've gotten more involved in recent days with Tour.com and with SF Signal, but primarily for most of the time, you've been with SFF World, which is frankly a pretty iconic thing at this point. I mean, it's on just about every SFF novel of the last decade. I mean, how many of your reviews have been quoted on the back cover of a book?
Honestly, I haven't kept count. I know the first one that, you know, that I was pretty proud of was The Darkness That Comes Before by Scott Baker. And that was when Overlook published the hardcover of the U.S. edition 03 or 04. Because he reached out to us and I got the Canadian version of his book. It looked the same. It just... just was a trade paperback. But yeah, honestly, I haven't kept count. I'll admit that I go into bookstores, and if I'm in the book in the science fiction section, I'll thumb through some things to see if my reviews are on anything that I've reviewed. But, you know, I don't have a tally or anything.
But often you're identified as SFF World, right? Not as Rob Bedford.
Yeah. And you know what? That's how, on one sense, it's a little frustrating, but on another, I mean, that's how all reviews are. I mean, you look, I got Elizabeth Moon's book back here. It says the Star Ledger on it. It doesn't say the reviewer. Books say Washington Post. It doesn't say the reviewer name. So I just saw that as the way things were done. Occasionally, you know, the publisher will call out my name specifically. I've got a few of those, but mostly it's just SFF World.
Yeah, I feel like some publishers are better about that than others. I think Orbit uses the blogger name fairly frequently, which is nice, I think, for them to do that.
Yeah, and both of the ones that my name is in are Dan Simmons books, and there are only two Simmons books I've read in the past decade, so.
The question is, did you read them because your name were on them? Oh, maybe it doesn't work like that.
No.
So things are kind of going a little haywire for reviewers lately.
I mean, the shit hits the fan about something different every couple weeks. So it's you know, the controversy of the week or every 2 weeks.
Yeah,
is the way I say it.
So we had Kathleen Hale stalking Blythe Harris. We have the self-published Richard Brattain and his wine bottle. We've had the Requires Hate kerfuffle. And all of this is kind of been going on. And It seems like there's no question that the relationship between the author and the blogger or the reviewer is still evolving, right?
Yeah, it's a living thing. It's not static. It's dynamic.
Do you feel like it's changed significantly since you started? I mean, when you started blogging, I mean, how much contact did you have with authors?
Not a lot. A lot of my contact was through the publicists or the marketing folks who were sending the books. If I was going to interview an author, it would a lot of times be set up by the publisher. Sometimes the interview would go from me to the publisher and the publisher to the author. And there are still a couple that go like that. But what I'm seeing now, I guess, is self-published authors in the past would reach out directly to me and interact with me as opposed to the website. And now all authors are interacting with the reviewers in that way. You know, more direct contact with the reviewers, trying to build a relationship with us before, you know, shoving their books down our throats, which, you know, we want to know you, and we also want to read the books too. So it's, you know, that they're, the writers are, you know, towing a tricky line too, I guess.
And we have to think that this is happening. I mean, in the beginning, when you started blogging, social media didn't really exist. I mean, MySpace, maybe.
MySpace wasn't even in existence when I started, so.
Right. And so in a pre-social media world, the only time you were interacting with authors was at a convention. Mm-hmm. And the wall at a convention would have been much higher because you hadn't sort of pre-sold yourself through social media. So you were sort of, if you needed a convention, you were going in cold with authors. I mean, that level of warmth that we have today wasn't present. And so I have to think that social media is 99% of why this is happening.
Absolutely. Like, I was at New York Comic Con in October. And the only reason I went up to say hello to Chuck Wending and chat with him for a few minutes is because I had interacted with him on Twitter. I mean, I'd read his books, too. And I may have, you know, said, hi, Chuck, this, that, the other thing. But I felt more comfortable, you know, tapping him on the shoulder and introducing myself because of the interaction we had on Twitter. And I, you know, good or bad, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know if that makes the authors feel, I don't know how that makes them feel on the other side of what we do.
Mm-hmm. If you were trying to define your relationship to the authors that you review, I mean, how would you define that? I mean, what's your concept of that relationship, if you can articulate it?
Well, a lot of times in my mind, a book is a conversation between the writer and the reader. And on one hand, I'm having a conversation with them when I read the book. And I guess when I write the review, I'm sharing that conversation with other people who may be interested in the book or the writer, or, you know, if the person knows my reviews and they have a similar taste to me or like the opposite of what I like, it's still a conversation that's happening through the review.
So,
I never thought of it that way until I just said it.
Do you see yourself as a reviewer as speaking to your audience, speaking to the writers, or speaking solely for yourself?
If I am in love with the book, then I think I'm speaking for, I think I'm partially speaking for myself and for the writer, because I enjoy the book a lot and I want other people to enjoy it. And if the author brought me a few hours of time well spent reading the book, I want, you know, that experience to be shared with other people.
And if you didn't like the book?
A warning.
I mean, so at that point, you're speaking more to your audience.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
And I have great perspective. I can put great perspective on this now that my career as a blogger is quasi over.
Yeah, well.
Only quasi, because I'm still blogging. I'm just not blogging for myself anymore.
Right.
And for those that don't know, I've recently closed down Staffer's Book Review.
On the same day I turned 10 years old on my blog. Coincidence?
It's a great symmetry, isn't it? So
yeah.
After I guess I've been going about almost 4 years now, 3.5 years or something like that, now that I'm stepping away. You know, I've always viewed my relationship to blogging and to the author and to the reviewer as I didn't give a shit. I mean, what I was writing was for me, mm-hmm. and for my own edification. Yeah, I mean, I wrote it to reflect on what I read for myself. If if the audience that read me took something away from it, or an author were to take something away from it, I really don't care. That's not what I did it for. You've got sort of three strata of reviewers out there, and when I say reviewers, I mean people talking about books. And you've got your professionals, which is a rather short list, you know, Locus, you know, Gary Wolf at Locus, and, you know, you have sort of like Nancy Hightower for the Washington Post, and you have, I think Nora Jemison is writing for...
she does stuff for the Times now.
Right.
Much better than the guy they had a few years ago who, you know, he didn't get into the nitty-gritty in the same way that Nora is, I don't think.
And so you've got a real handful of pros, and then you've got this huge group of bloggers who aren't they're fans, but they're also trying to create a professional level product. And then you've got fans, which are like your Goodreads reviewers that are out there just sort of reviewing off the cuff. And I don't know how you can sort of reconcile that.
I for a while I was posting reviews on Goodreads after I posted them wherever I was posting them. And I don't know, it to me, you're right, there is a line between just doing your reviews on Amazon and Goodreads and then having, you know, a venue that's not just for selling the books, like Tor, like SF Signal, like, you know, SF Site and all these other places. And I don't know... how blurry that line is, if it's a screen door, if it's a storm door, but there is a division there, and it's not something you can easily put your finger on and define, but just to know that it's there. It's not a negative against either set of people. It's just, it seems like there's a difference.
I would postulate that one of the problems that we're experiencing, and I mentioned those three scenarios earlier, and there have been a dozen other ones, from the Ben Aronovich dust up with the book smugglers to
Anne Rice years ago,
sure,
on Amazon.
Sure, exactly. And the list really just goes on and on. I mean, Terry Goodkind has flipped out at Aidan Moher before, and
I still get my favorite email that I receive is a notification to that I subscribe to one of the comments on Aidan's blog about Terry Goodkind, and at least once a year I'll still get a comment on, you know, somebody will respond to his blog post about Terry Goodkind from, I think, 2008 or 2009. And it just puts a little smile on my face that people are still talking about that silly thing.
Right. This happens all the time, but I can't help but wonder, I think this is what's happening, is that you've got this spectrum of reviewer and blogger, and then you've got this spectrum of author. Mm-hmm. And particularly in the science fiction and fantasy world, authors go from fan to pro in the span of 0 to 60. I mean, it's like they're one second they're squeeing about something, and the next second, you know, they're trying to pitch their own product. And then on the reviewer side, I mean, we all got into it mostly because we love the books. And so I think most of these problems are occurring because we can't see the line between where the fan begins or where the fan ends and the pro begins. Does that make sense? Is that maybe what's going on?
It's a tough line. It's there. And some people don't seem to see the line or don't care about the line. I know I'm probably being a little hypocritical, but sometimes I feel like I can see the line sometimes. I mean, I guess the line is you don't want to go beyond saying, thanks, author, you wrote a really good book, here's my review. And that's, you know, that's where the interaction kind of should stay once the review that you wrote about the author's book is out there. Because any dialogue that's out in public is not going to make either party look good. If the author has an issue with a review that's written, maybe contact the reviewer directly, if at all. And nothing, you know, don't comment on it on Amazon or anything like that. But the line is there. And, you know, it's not always easy to see, like you say. Because you see folks like, you know, I'll bring up Chuck again. you know, he was squeeing about Joe Hill's book last year, Nosferatu. I love the book, and it just, you know, a lot of the writers are fans too. Like you said, they get into writing because they like the books, they like reading.
And this is a challenge, even when you're talking about an author's work and they want to talk about their own work with the reviewer, is the author can feel like they're engaging you in a fan conversation about their own work, which I wouldn't advise any author to do. But
no.
But I can see where they make that mistake, that they think, well, I'm just having a conversation one fan to another here. And the reality is that's not what's taking place. But I really believe, and Robert Jackson Bennett wrote rather eloquently about this. Everything he writes is rather eloquent, even if
he's... Yeah, he's one of the smartest guys.
Even when he's wrong. Mm-hmm. And in this case, he might have been a little bit wrong, but, you know, Robert Jackson Bennett said that he really thinks... We always assume that the author has superior power, or, you know, has more power in a situation than a reviewer. And he sort of flipped that and said, wait a second, not really. He said that the reviewer has just as much power in that relationship as the author does. Mm-hmm. That an author, once they let their work go, has no control over it. And this, you know, the reviewer has sole discretion to do what they want with it. And I don't know how to respond to that. I mean, I personally never find an author coming in to interact in a fan space to be threatening, because it just doesn't bother me. But I could see where it does others. And I respect that it can bother some others. And so I kind of tend to agree personally with Robert that I sometimes feel that the blogger or the reviewer does have a rather large amount of power, particularly with authors who aren't established.
Yeah, and... You know, you said that with science fiction and fantasy world being around forever. Well, a lot of the stuff that we see on Twitter now, the author and fan slash reviewer slash blogger reaction, you know, we saw a lot of that at SFF World, you know, 7-8 years ago before Twitter, when authors would come in, and it was a lot better to engage with an author who didn't talk about their work at all. Just, you know, one author would come in and say, oh, you know, I'm a big fan of David Gemmell, read all of his books, this, that, the other thing. And then maybe somebody else in the forum who, you know, just, you know, a fan would say, oh, you're so-and-so, I've read your books. And then a lot of times when the author was smart, they would kind of deflect, you know, the stuff about themselves and their work and try and redirect conversation about, you know, Gemmell or Tad Williams or some other author, so that they weren't seen as just being there to simply sell, you know, their own work. And I think that kind of interaction, you know, I see some of that on Twitter now. And I think that is a healthier type of interaction, because, you know, you're just talking both as fans. And on that level, you know, I think that's where the equality is.
No, I think that's right. You know, I think that, you know, we've obviously seen, you know, folks in the author interaction advice business, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's Mary Robinette Kowal or Chuck, again, who are offering advice to newer writers about when to engage and when not to engage, and generally the practice being don't engage on your own work ever. Except what's funny about that, and it seems often disingenuous to me, that it's perfectly fine to engage somebody on about the good stuff about your book. If somebody loves your book, oh, feel free to engage on the fact they love your book, but don't engage if they don't like your book. And that seems kind of odd to me. I mean, if there's a wall, there's a wall, right?
Yeah.
Don't interact with a reviewer about your own work, if that's the policy.
I think if an author and reviewer slash fan interaction is going to happen about the author's work, the fan has to kind of initiate it, and the author should be cognizant of, as we're saying, this wall that's there. And, you know, don't get, maybe not get too excited if they say they like the book. I don't know. We're in a world where like you said, the interaction between fan and pro is, the lines are blurrier. So what are the rules?
Well, I don't know. And this is very true of me, and I'll talk about my own experience with it in a second. But, you know, I've been with you, Rob, at a publisher party, mm-hmm. where we are interacting with authors with whom We are very friendly.
Yeah.
Some of which you might even call friend. Mm-hmm. Some of whom you have reviewed or will review in the future. And how do you handle that? I mean, what do you review people whom you know well? And how do you keep distance?
It's not easy to keep distance, and you have to, you know, if you think of yourself as a friend to the writer, then you have to be honest either way. You don't want to blow sunshine up their ass. You don't want to tell them that their book is great when in actuality you had problems with it, because if they want to have a career, you know, if they're working on a career, you know, they should know what worked and didn't work for certain readers, I guess.
Well, then, of course, the response is, if I'm said author, I would have loved an email to that effect, Rob, about what worked and didn't work. But releasing it to your several thousand readers was probably not what I wanted.
True. It gets hard when you know the people personally like that. If you have a good relationship with them, I think it's only natural to be inclined to be a little more forgiving in a review than you might otherwise be if you didn't know them.
Yeah, it's natural, right? It's human nature.
Yeah, feelings and stuff.
But a problem for a reviewer in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
If you're trying to maintain a level of credibility and with both your audience and with publishers and with your peers. You know, I have several authors with who I consider to be very close friends. Mm-hmm. Mike Cole and I are very close friends. And there are, Wesley Chu and I are very close, and there's a handful of others that I consider very close personal friends, people who I talk to on a daily basis, not on social media. But there's a point at which you have to stop, right? I can no longer. I mean, the fact I've beta read all of Mike's books multiple times before they even, you know, get to the editor at this mm-hmm. point, you know, pretty much takes me out of reviewing any of his work. But you know, there's that point at which, before we got that level of relationship, where I was still reviewing his work, but we were good friends, but not perhaps close friends. And it's very interesting to see where that line draws. And I've had several instances where I've had to provide a rather negative review of a friend. It's a challenge. Most of them have handled it very well, and it's never really been an issue. You know, as I was sitting here, I was trying to think of a specific example of somebody who I just raked over the coals, who gave me a high five, you know, who never brought it up again, you know. And I can't think of a great example, although Cameron Hurley, you know, her new book, Mirror Empire, I did not give a glowing review to. I was fairly critical of it. And Cameron's response on Twitter was, I mean, Cameron and I know each other too well for her to just not say anything.
Right, right.
But so her response was sort of like, oh, I would have worried if you liked everything in it, you know?
And yeah, I don't think that's a pretty perfect response, I think.
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, and you know, she didn't shy away from it. She embraced the fact that I was critical of it and accepted that I could be critical about it. And that was fine. It wasn't some sort of invalidation of our relationship or what have you. Now, this is, again, though, part of why I no longer am blogging. Mm-hmm. Because there's a challenge that comes where I've become too close to too many people, I think, to continue to be sort of an impartial reviewer. Like, I think I'm getting to the point where that's a problem.
Yeah. There are certain authors where, you know, you have to recuse yourself from reviewing their work, whether or not you have a relationship with them the way you're saying, or you know, what you've read from them, you've just loved, and you can't be impartial about it. And that's another thing that we have to think about too, when we're looking at these books and talking about them, I think.
Look, Rob, you better not be fucking implying that I'm not intellectually honest about K.J. Parker. Is that what you're implying right now?
Oh, no. I was talking about authors that that's tough for me to be impartial.
Oh, okay.
As I look at my Tad Williams shelf and my Joe Hill books. I think I mentioned this before earlier today. I saw Birdman over the weekend, and there's a very relevant 5-minute conversation in the film that parallels some of what we're talking about, and it immediately made me think of Robert Jackson Bennett's posts. Michael Keaton plays an actor who is in a superhero movie called Birdman, kind of like Batman. And now he's trying to be a legitimate actor. He wrote, directed, and starring in a play on Broadway. And he's struggling with it. He's working really hard. He's hearing voices in his head. And he's at a bar, and the New York Times theater critic is sitting at the bar. She has a good conversation with Edward Norton's character, who's a theater actor. And then Michael Keaton goes to speak to her a little bit later, and she totally rips him apart, saying, you know, I'm not going to give your play a good review, which sends him into a spiral of getting all in her face and yelling at her. And that type of artist and critic relationship, it's a dangerous line. And I guess the timing was right for me to see the movie this weekend, because it spoke to a lot of what we're talking about now. And does the artist ever have a right to yell at a critic like that? I don't think so. What if the critic says, I'm not even going to look at your product, I'm just going to give it a bad review? Does that give the artist right to talk to the critic in that way?
I don't know. And a great question is, you know, like the I gave your book a 1-star review because it was too expensive.
Yeah, that invalidates anything that person has to say, though.
It does, in my opinion, it does. But does it give the author some sort of the creator some pass to get after that person, to be critical of the critic, if you will?
I think a little bit, especially if they say, I'm not even going to, I'm just going to give you a negative view sight unseen. And that's where I think Robert is saying that the critic has all the power, because this critic, you know, was made out to be so important in the theater world that any, you know, she could literally make or break a person's career, is how it was actually said in the film. So it's a slippery slope, I guess.
And do we have that here?
No. I mean, we have, I'd say if these, you know, these 4 or 5 reviewers don't like your book, forget it. And even that's a stretch.
Well, yeah, I mean, if these 4 or 5 reviewers don't like your book, forget the online community. But at the end of, you know, the people that read reviews. But at the end of the day, I think, at least in our field, there's still a very small percentage of people that engage reviews, at least professional or highly quality amateur reviews. There's a very small number of people that engage on those. I mean, by and large, most people buy books still based on word of mouth or recommendation.
Yep.
Or more and more just an Amazon algorithm that tells them they might like it.
Yeah.
The reviews are an interesting beast. You know, I do think we can make successes with the online reviews.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's any question.
I agree with that.
I don't think there's any question Ancillary Justice or Goblin Emperor or any of these sorts of books got a boost. God's War by Cameron Hurley got a significant boost by this online buzz that was created around those books. But I don't think we've tanked Terry Goodkind's career with our negative reviews. I don't think we've tanked Scott Baker's career based on his negative reviews.
Those are two entirely hour-long conversations in and of themselves, I think, those two writers.
Yeah. But I think that's the interesting part, too, is this misperception that the review even matters. And I hate to say this, because as a reviewer, as a blogger, as somebody who's become heavily invested in this, as somebody who gets books from publicists, who's somebody who gets paid by Tor.com to talk about books, does the review even matter?
Yeah, it does. I'm not to toot my own horn, but I've had a good number of people tell me that they've picked up a book because they read my review of the book. So it matters. I don't know how much, but, you know, it does mean that, you know, if people read a review from someone they trust and they're waiting to read the review of someone they trust, I'm not even saying myself, Paul Weimer on SF Signal, people like the same things he likes. If they, you know, if he reviews a book that they're thinking about and they buy it because of his review, it's there. We do have an impact. I don't know how big or how significant of an impact, but it's there.
So I will agree that the review in mass, right, whether it's me or you or Falls Meadows or Abigail Nussbaum or
anybody, or the Smugglers.
Book Smugglers, anybody else. I think as an individual, I don't know that any of us have any significant impact. Yeah, as you mentioned, there are a few here and there. I mean, I probably, when I, you know, my blog probably had, I don't know, let's just pull a number out, 50 people that actually listen to what I have to say. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot more readers than that, but probably 50 of them only gave a shit what I had to say. But as a group, right, there's massive social power.
Yeah.
Because I believe that reviewing is a domino effect. It's something publicists, I think, still struggle with. Because I think sometimes publicists make the mistake of just trying to place content with big sites. And mm-hmm. I don't think they realize it's like this domino effect. You know, it's like if you can hit enough dominoes to fall, eventually they keep knocking over all the other dominoes. You know, if 15 of the tiny blogs read a book and love it, well, you're going to get two medium blogs out of that. And if those two medium blogs, you're going to get one big blog. And it all snowballs. It seems.
Yeah, it is a collective, and it's almost like Hydra. You know, people like us who get the books, you know, we don't have to go out and buy them. So it's not like, you know, we're going to get a sale from each other. But, you know, if you or the Book Smugglers positively reviewed something that I already own, it's going to jump the pile. So it's getting readers. Is it getting sales? What's more important? And those are different questions, I think.
And I've always said that there are certain authors that will read something because I liked it. And author has greater social power than a reviewer, and if that author reads it, and it goes on and so forth. So yeah, no, I think that's true, and I guarantee you, I'm any review I write is a guaranteed sale if I liked it, because my mom buys everything I review positively.
There you go.
If I ever write a book, my mom's gonna buy it. So
yeah,
you know, well, she's a dedicated buyer.
And my dad keeps asking me when he can see the manuscript that I'm working on, and he's going to be the last person to see it because he'll be the least impartial person. I won't get anything critical out of him.
Yeah, no, parents are terrible. My mom thinks I'm a brilliant blogger. She's full of shit.
She doesn't even know you're not blogging anymore, I bet. She's going to be devastated.
She probably
will. More importantly, Cheryl's out of work. What's going to happen to Cheryl?
Yeah, for those who don't know, Cheryl is my erstwhile assistant on the blog. I made her up. My wife's a little bit jealous of her. She would negatively review books in a clever and funny way. You know, I don't know. Yeah, Cheryl's probably retired, unless Tor.com lets me start writing a column in Cheryl's voice. We'll see. We'll see how that goes. I could just see it now, like a fictional blogger. That'd be interesting. I'm going to cite an interesting author interaction I had, and it was with Brian Stavely, who wrote The Emperor's Blades.
I happen to be reading that right now.
Which I think you're reading right now, right? So maybe we could talk a little bit about the book in a second. But I wrote a review of that book that was largely positive. I was a little bit critical of a few things. The largest one is that there are three points of view in the novel. Three siblings, two brothers, and a sister. Mm-hmm. And the sister gets, I don't know, maybe 10% of the page count or less. But on the cover copy, she sounds like, you know, an equal with the men in terms of the importance of the story, but she gets very little page count, and I was very annoyed by it. In fact, the only...
Keep in mind, it's the first of a series.
Right. But you know, I think when reviewing a book, it's fair to call out each individual book for its merits, and in this case, I said I thought the book would have been better served by having more of her, because she was a very good character, and I thought she got short shrift. And so... Brian Stavely sent me an email, and we had a whole conversation about it, a rather extensive conversation about it, and it went very well. And I think Brian's a swell dude. But that conversation was the way that, if we're going to talk about this author blogger relationship, that's what needs to happen. You know, as I look at this Kathleen Hale situation and this,
that's a nightmare.
And this Richard Britton and his wine bottle. You know, I'm like, could you send the blogger an email?
I know. It's unhinged people are everywhere, and those two just prove it. You think people who are reading and writing books have it a little more together up in their head, but no.
And I have to wonder if that's how much, you know, we spent so much time, we've just spent 40 minutes talking about how we can solve or look at this blogger author relationship, and you start to wonder yourself, is there a problem, or is it just crazy people are going to be crazy?
And I think it's a lot of it's crazy people are going to be crazy.
I mean, any other field, we would the conversation. I mean, I'm looking at Gamergate or any of these other things that have been going on out there, and it's just sort of like you can't stop, you know, the Unabomber. You know,
no.
And these are sort of the Unabombers of the author blogger relationship. If you, I mean, they're outliers. And as much as we'd love to talk it away, to convince everybody that this sort of behavior is not acceptable and is horrible to a healthy community, I don't know that we can fix it.
You know? No. Crazy people are going to be crazy, yo. And, you know, next year there's going to be another hater or a person who doesn't have all their cards in the deck going after a reviewer / author. It's something's going to happen. I mean, I don't know that we'll see it to the extreme that we saw the physical things from Hale or the words from Requires Hate, but you know, there's people are crazy.
Let's talk about happier things, Rob.
Yeah.
So you were reading The Emperor's Blades.
Yes, I am. Actually, 2 years ago at Comic-Con, Brian was on a panel with Elizabeth Baer, Scott Lynch, Michael Sullivan, and I'm sorry for the other authors who I can't remember were on it, but out of all of those, Brian stood out to me with, you know, positing such a good outlook on what he was doing, and he sounded really smart, and that made me, you know, that put his book in my head. And, you know, I'm reading it now a lot because of that and because I've seen a lot of good things said about it. And it reminds me so far of David Anthony Durham's Acacia books, which I reread and caught up with last year. I read the first book in the series in 07 when it first published. Liked it a lot. Never got around to book 2 and 3 until last year, and I love that series, and the fact that that Stavely's book is echoing that in some sense bodes well for, you know, the next 350 pages of the book.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the Acacia series. Nethspace, Ken from Nethspace, the blog, wrote a really smart review of that talked about it being one of the few epic fantasies that's actually about changing the status quo.
Yeah.
Which is a great... great perspective on that book. Anybody who's interested in the Acacia book should go read the Nethspace review of it. But
yeah, he writes good reviews.
He does.
He's quite busy with real life now, but he's one of the other Blogosaurus Rexes of the world. And I guess he and I started blogging around the same time, and he's always got smart things to say.
Yeah, he makes me feel guilty for folding my blog because I didn't have enough time. He's comfortable with only blogging once every 2 months. Like, that makes me crazy. I just feel guilty, so I can't do that.
Right, but you've got this thing and whatever else you're doing at tour.
I got all kinds of stuff going on.
It's not like you're being quiet, much to everybody's chagrin.
Amen. But yeah, but Brian's book, we'll see if it gets status quo challenging. I would argue the first book's pretty status quo, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. He seems to be having, and this is something that I feel like more and more and more we don't get enough from fantasy authors. I feel like Brian is having a lot of fun when he writes his books.
And actually, the tallest man in science fiction and fantasy, Sam Sykes, has been talking about Stavely's books on Twitter. And instead of buying Sam's book, I've been reading Brian's book because of how the good things that Sam's been saying about them.
He has. Sam has been saying good things about them. And I think there's that – and Sam Sykes, for those who don't know, is incredibly critical – has been incredibly critical of the Grimdark movement, and his argument being that it sort of sucks the air out of the room. And Sam is a big proponent of bringing back fun and thrills. And I think thrills less than more than fun. I mean, it doesn't have to be lighthearted. It just has to be thrilling. There's a real sense of thrill to the Emperor's Blades, particularly Valen is just a fun to read, right? Although not as badass as the this is the one thing that bugs the shit out of me about this book. Stavely is constantly talking about how awesome Valen is and how awesome the Ketrick are, but Valen, and you've already seen it to some degree, like he fails a lot.
Yeah. Well, what did they say in Batman Begins? Why do we fall down? So we learn how to get up. So you can't succeed without failing a lot.
That's fair. That's fair. But it's always like, you elite special forces dudes. But he always seems to lose. It's kind of like a verbal tick, you know? It's like we're an author.
Yeah.
This is like a verbal tick. And you're like, but no. But yeah, I know he's awesome. But why does he keep losing? Stop saying he's awesome.
Yeah, show, don't tell.
Yeah, yes, exactly. But I know I have Providence of Fire, which is the second book in the series, and I'm very eager to get to it. This is the other problem about being a blogger that I'm freed from now. You know, I used to always have, like, I used to do, like, reading triage, which is sort of like, okay, this isn't due out till January, so I don't want to write my review until December, but I don't want to read it now.
You and I are in the same mindset there.
Right, so I would always put stuff off, right? So I'd be like, okay, because like I have like right now, you know, sitting on my shelf, I've got Half a World, the new Joe Abercrombie, I've got Karen Memory, the new Elizabeth Bear, I've got, you know, the new Brian Staley. So I've got all these books from January and February, and it's like, I can't read them yet, because I've got stuff that's out in December. I have to do the three-body problem. I have to do, you know, the new Rachel Bach book or whatever. Like I have these, it's triage.
And I knew I wanted to get to Emperor's Blades before the end of the year. That much I knew, despite any other books. Well, so yeah, I'm the same way. If I know I've got 3 months out to get to the book, I'd rather read it closer to the pub date so I can get the review closer to the pub date. And here we are talking about that reviewer relationship again, I guess.
Well, that's a great question. It's like the whole pub date thing is fascinating. You know, Mike Cole tweeted the other day that, you know, there are review copies of his book going out now, but he would ask that reviewers hold them until January because that's what's best for, you know, sort of sales perspective. But and it's sort of like, well, who am I writing the review for? Am I writing a review to help you sell books, or am I writing a review to help readers? Maybe, or am I writing it for myself? You know, that whole thing is, I don't know how to do that. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what the right answer is. You know, Tor.com tries to publish their reviews, you know, the week of publication,
yep.
Which is cool. They also want me to submit them 2 weeks before that, which I just laugh at.
Yeah, I have a hard time doing that too. That's the good thing about SFF World and SF Signal. A lot of the stuff I do for... Well, only one thing with SF Signal has a real hard deadline, but everything else is, excuse me, kind of do it when you want to do it and post it when you want to post it.
Yeah, that is the one thing about having my own blog that I will miss. It's just sort of I can just throw it up whenever I feel like it. Though admittedly, I'm sure like Chris Luff and the other production staff at Tor.com are like rolling their eyes at me right now because they know. Like, invariably, I submit stuff on deadline the day it's due. So
I usually try, I tend to submit it late Friday.
Or I should say, I don't submit it on the deadline due date. I submit it when it's supposed to publish.
You're a bad boy.
I am a bad boy. I'm very guilty.
Another fun set of books, real quick, the big omnibus I just finished was Julie Cernadas' Species Imperative. It's a gigantic omnibus, and it's a really neat look at aliens. From a biologist perspective. And we usually see hard science fiction not from a biology perspective. And that's what's cool and fun about those books.
Is that a Daw?
Yeah,
Daw. Yeah. She I've never actually read her work. I tried to read A Turn of Light, but it was a little slow for me in the beginning bits. But I will say that's one of the best things about Daw as a publisher is they give their books a long life.
And they're good to their authors. They keep their omnibus program, keeping their authors in print is, you know, it's good. That's why authors stay with Daw for a while, I think.
Well, I think that's why oftentimes they sell, right? Because they're there. They're on the shelf. They're always present. You know, they never go away. I think that's a big deal. Pat Rothfuss, they've certainly given him plenty of time to find his vision.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, he's getting there. I haven't read The Slow Regard yet.
I have read The Slow Regard of Silent Things.
You probably read it in the 5 minutes that you were that I was talking before.
You know, I actually got it on audiobook.
Yeah,
it's a little odd to hear Patrick Rothfuss narrate Ari's voice because she's got this sort of like elfin thing going on, and Pat's
not a she,
and does not have an elfin persona in any way, shape, or form. So it was kind of interesting, but
although he can hold the room with a story, that's for sure.
He's a wonderful storyteller, and the lyrical nature of the prose is phenomenal. Like, he almost invents a new language for Ari. I mean, the way that he communicates her voice in the novel, it's fantastic. I mean, there's no dialogue. There's only one character. It's just all, you know, this third person voice, and it's incredible. However, it's like there's not really a narrative. Like it's like Ari describing her week. You know, it's like Ari goes to the pool, Ari washes her body, Ari looks for a gift for both. Like it's a challenge from a narrative perspective.
But it's still fascinating to read or listen to, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think it's worth it. Now, you know, I don't know that I would, if I'm a big Pat Roth's Kingkiller Chronicle fan, I might be a little dissatisfied with a hardcover of a very short novella.
Right. But he tells you not to buy the book in the beginning of it, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, which kind of bugged me. I'm sort of like, if you feel like you have to apologize for it, why are you publishing it? Like, just stand behind it, man. Like, it is what it is. Stand behind it, brother.
Yeah. That's what I say. I see both arguments. I haven't read the full warning, so to speak, so I don't know.
I think he probably feels compelled to, like, he has different fans, right? He has, like, the fans who appreciate Pat the artist, and then there are people who just want more fan service of Quoth. So maybe he feels like they need to respond to both, but I don't know. I'm like, just own it, dude.
Yeah, it is what it is.
Your publisher gave you six figures, and you hit number four on the New York Times bestseller list with it. Just own it, dude.
Yeah, be happy about it.
Yeah, man. I mean, you don't have to. If you hit number four on the New York Times bestseller list, you apologize for nothing.
Well, Gaiman's book last year was kind of short, and I don't think he was apologizing for it. He even said it was a book he accidentally wrote, and he winds up, you know, hit number one last year.
Well, I think that's what happened with this too. I don't think he had any intention of really, you know, like selling this thing. In fact, he kind of tells the story behind the publication and the book and admits that, like, I never really thought this would sell. In fact, it was supposed to be a Subterranean Press novella, but Daw ended up buying it. And I will say, like, I think it is an award-worthy piece of fiction, a piece of prose, right? Like, it's really a fantastic creation. I just, from a reader perspective, it's just a lack of narrative is unique. I don't know if I would have read it in book form. Listening to it in audio was perfect because I could just enjoy the language.
Right.
This has been Rob Bedford talking about the author-blogger relationship and a few other books.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Rocket Talk.